But like or dislike the people is something peculiar he could not only because he lived with the people and all his interests were bound up with theirs, but also because he regarded himself as a part of the people, did not see any peculiar qualities or failings distinguishing himself from the people, and could not contrast himself with them. Moreover, although he had lived so long in the closest relations with the peasants, as farmer and arbitrator, and what was more, as advisor, the peasants trusted him, and for 40 verstas round they would come to ask his advice. He had no definite views of the people, and would have been as much at a loss to answer the questions whether he knew the people as the question whether he liked them. For him to say he knew the people would have been the same as to say he knew men. He was continually watching and getting to know people of all sorts, and among them peasants, whom he regarded as good and interesting people, and he was continually observing new points in them, altering his former views of them and forming new ones. With Sergei Ivanovich, it was quite the contrary. Just as he liked and praised the country life in comparison with the life he did not like, so too he liked the people, in contradistinction to the class of men he did not like, and so too he knew the people as something distinct from and opposed to men in general. In his methodical brain there were distinctly formulated certain aspects of peasant life, deduced partly from that life itself, but chiefly from contrast with other modes of life. He never changed his opinion of the people and his sympathetic attitude toward them. In the discussions that arose between the brothers on their views of the people, Sergei Ivanovich always got the better of his brother, precisely because Sergei Ivanovich had definite ideas about the peasant, his character, his qualities, and his taste. Konstantin Levin had no definite and unalterable idea on the subject, and so in their arguments, Konstantin was readily convicted of contradicting himself. In Sergei Ivanovich's eyes, his younger brother was a capital fellow with his heart in the right place, as he expressed it in French, but with a mind which, though fairly quick, was too much influenced by the impressions of the moment, and consequently filled with contradictions. With all the condescension of an elder brother, he sometimes explained to him the true import of things, but he derived little satisfaction from arguing with him, because he got the better of him too easily. Konstantin Levin regarded his brother as a man of immense intellect and culture, as generous in the highest sense of the word, and possessed of a special faculty for working for the public good. But in the depths of his heart, the older he became, and the more intimately he knew his brother, the more and more frequently the thought struck him that this faculty of working for the public good, of which he felt himself utterly devoid, was possibly not so much a quality as a lack of something, not a lack of good, honest, noble desires and tastes, but a lack of vital force, of what is called heart, of that impulse which drives a man to choose someone out of the innumerable paths of life and to care only for that one. The better he knew his brother, the more he noticed that Sergei Ivanovich and many other people who worked for the public welfare were not led by any impulse of the heart to care for the public good, but reasons from intellectual considerations that it was a right thing to take an interest in public affairs, and consequently took an interest in them. Levin was confirmed in this conjecture by observing that his brother did not take questions affecting the public welfare, or the question of the immortality of the soul a bit more to heart than he did chess problems, or the ingenious construction of a new machine. Besides this, Konstantin Levin was not at his ease with his brother, because in the country, especially in summertime, Levin was continually busy with work on the land, and the long summer day was not long enough for him to get through all he had to do, while Sergei Ivanovich was merely taking a holiday. But though he was taking a holiday now, that is to say, he was doing no writing, he was so used to intellectual activity that he liked to put into concise and eloquent shape the ideas that occurred to him, and liked to have someone listen to him. His most usual and natural listener was his brother. And so, in spite of the friendliness and directness of their relations, Konstantin felt an awkwardness in leaving him alone. Sergei Ivanovich liked to stretch himself on the grass in the sun and to lie so, basking and chatting lazily. "You wouldn't believe," he would say to his brother, "what a pleasure this rural laziness is to me. Not an idea in one's brain, as empty as a drum." But Konstantin Levin found it dull sitting and listening to him, especially when he knew that while he was away, manure would be carted into fields not plowed ready for it, and heaped up God knows how, and the shares in the plows would not be screwed in, so that they would come off, and then his men would say the new plows were a silly invention, and there was nothing like the old wooden plow, and so on. "Come, you've done enough trudging about in the heat," Sergei Ivanovich would say to him. "No, I must just run around to the counting house for a minute," Levin would answer, and would run off to the fields. Chapter 2. Early in June, Agatha Mikhailovna, the old nurse and housekeeper, in carrying us to the cellar a jar of mushrooms she had just pickled, happened to slip, fall, and sprain her wrist. The district doctor, a talkative young medico who had just finished his studies, came to see her. He examined the wrist, said it was not luxated, bandaged it, and being asked to dinner, evidently was delighted at a chance of talking to the celebrated Sergei Ivanovich Koznishev. And to show his advanced views of things, told him all the scandal of the district, complaining of the poor state into which the Zemstvo affairs had fallen. Sergei Ivanovich listened attentively, asked him questions, and roused by a new listener, he talked fluently, uttered a few keen and weighty observations, respectfully appreciated by the young doctor, and was soon in that animated frame of mind his brother knew so well, which always with him followed a brilliant and animated conversation. After the departure of the doctor, he wanted to go with a fishing rod to the river. Sergei Ivanovich was fond of angling and was, it seemed, proud of being able to care for such a stupid occupation. Konstantin Levin, whose presence was needed in the plowland and the meadows, had come to take his brother in the cabriolet. It was that time of the year, the turning point of summer, when the crops of the present year are a certainty, when one begins to think of the sowing for next year and the mowing is at hand, when the rye is all in ear, though its ears are still light, not yet full, and it waves in gray-green billows in the wind, when the green oats with tufts of yellow grass scattered here and there among them droop irregularly over the late-sown fields, when the early buckwheat is already out and hiding the ground, when the fallow lands, trodden hard as stone by the cattle, are half-plowed over with paths left untouched by the plow, when the odor from the dry manure heaps carted into the fields mingles at sunset with the smell of meadow sweet, and on the low-lying lands the preserved meadows are a thick sea of grass waiting for the mowing, with blackened heaps of sorrel stalks among it. It was the time when there comes a brief pause in the toil of the fields before the beginning of the labors of harvest, every year recurring, every year claiming all the peasants' thews. The crop was a splendid one, and bright, hot summer days had set in with short, dewy nights. The brothers had to drive through the woods to reach the meadows. Sergei Ivanovich was all the while admiring the beauty of the woods, which were a tangled mass of leaves, pointing out to his brother now an old lime tree on the point of flowering, dark on the shady side and brightly spotted with yellow stipules, now the young shoots of this year's saplings brilliant with emerald. Konstantin Levin did not like talking and hearing about the beauty of nature. Words for him took away the beauty of what he saw. He assented to what his brother said, but could not help thinking of other things. When they came out of the woods, all his attention was engrossed by the view of the fallow land on the upland, in parts yellow with grass, in parts trampled and checkered with furrows, in parts dotted with ridges of manure, and in parts even plowed. A string of telegasts was moving across it. Levin counted the telegasts and was pleased that all that were wanted had been brought, and at the sight of the meadows his thoughts passed to the mowing. He always felt something peculiar moving him to the quick at haymaking. On reaching the meadow, Levin stopped the horse. The morning dew was still lying on the thick undergrowth of the grass, and that he might not get his feet wet, Sergey Ivanovich asked his brother to drive him in the cabriolet up to the willow tree from which the perch were caught. Sorry as Konstantin Levin was to crush down his mowing grass, he drove him into the meadow. The high grass softly turned about the wheels and the horse's legs, leaving its seed clinging to the wet axles and spokes of the wheels. His brother seated himself under a bush, arranging his tackle, while Levin led the horse away, tied him up, and walked into the vast gray-green scene of grass, unstirred by the wind. The silky grass with its ripe seeds came almost to his waist in the riverside spots. Crossing the meadow, Konstantin Levin came out on the road and met an old man with a swollen eye carrying a swarming basket with bees. "What? Taken a stray swarm, Fomich?" he asked. "No, indeed, Konstantin Mitrich. All we can do to keep our own. This is the second new swarm that has flown away. Luckily, the lads caught them. They were plowing your field. They unyoked the horses and galloped after them." "Well, what do you say, Fomich? Start mowing or wait a bit?" "Well, now, our way is to wait till St. Peter's Day, but you always mow sooner. Well, to be sure, please God, the hay's good. There'll be plenty for the beasts." "What do you think about the weather?" "That's in God's hands. Maybe even the weather will favor us." Levin walked up to his brother. Sergey Ivanovich had caught nothing, but he was not bored and seemed in the most cheerful frame of mind. Levin saw that, stimulated by his conversation with the doctor, he wanted to talk. Levin, on the other hand, would have liked to get home as soon as possible to give orders about getting together the mowers for next day, and to set at rest his doubts about the mowing, which greatly absorbed him. "Well, let's be going," he said. "Why be in such a hurry? Let's stay a little." "But how wet you are. Even though one catches nothing, it's fine. That's the best thing about every part of sport. The one has to do with nature." "How exquisite this steely water is," said Sergey Ivanovich. "These riverside banks always remind me of the riddle. Do you know it? The grass says to the river, we quiver and we quiver." "I don't know the riddle," answered Levin cheerlessly. Chapter 3. "Do you know, I've been thinking about you," said Sergey Ivanovich. "It's beyond everything what's being done in the district, according to what this doctor tells me. He's a very intelligent fellow. And as I've told you before, I tell you again, it's not right for you not to go to the meetings and to keep out of the Zemstvo affairs entirely. If decent people won't go into it, of course it's bound to go all wrong. We pay the money and it all goes in salaries. And there are no schools, nor district dressers, nor midwives, nor pharmacies, nothing." "Well, I did try, you know," Levin said gently and unwillingly. "I can't, and so there's no help for it." "But why can't you?" "I must own I can't make it out. Indifference, incapacity, I won't admit. Surely it's not simple laziness." "None of those things. I've tried, and I see I can do nothing," said Levin. He had hardly grasped what his brother was saying. Looking toward the plowland across the river, he made out something black, but he could not distinguish whether it was a horse or the bailiff on horseback. "Why is it you can do nothing? You made an attempt and didn't succeed, as you think, and you give in. How can you have so little ambition?" "Ambition," said Levin, stung to the quick by his brother's words. "I don't understand. If they told me at college that other people understood the integral calculus, and I didn't, then ambition would have come in. But in this case, one wants first to be convinced that one has certain abilities for this sort of business, and especially that all this business is of great importance." "What? Do you mean to say it's not of importance?" said Sergey Ivanovich, stung to the quick in his turn by his brother's considering of no importance anything that interested him, and still more at his obviously paying little attention to what he was saying. "I don't think it's important. It does not take hold of me. I can't help it," answered Levin, making out that what he saw was the bailiff, and that the bailiff seemed to be letting the peasants go off plowed land. They were turning the plow over. Can they have finished plowing, he wondered. Come, really, though, said the elder brother with a frown on his handsome, clever face. There's a limit to everything. It's very well to be original and genuine and to dislike everything hypocritical. I know all about that, but really, what you're saying either has no meaning or it has a very wrong meaning. How can you think it a matter of no importance whether the people whom you love, as you assert, I never did assert it, thought Konstantin Levin, die without help, the ignorant peasant woman starve the children, and the people stagnate in darkness and are helpless in the hands of every village clerk, while you have at your disposal a means of helping them and don't help them because, to your mind, it's of no importance? And Sergei Ivanovich put before him the dilemma. Either you are so undeveloped that you can't see all that you can do, or you won't sacrifice your ease, your vanity, or whatever it is, to do it. Konstantin Levin felt that there was no course open to him but to submit, or to confess to a lack of zeal for the public good, and this mortified him and hurt his feelings. It's both, he said resolutely. I don't see that it is possible. What? Is it impossible if the money were properly laid out to provide medical aid? Impossible as it seems to me, for the 4,000 square verstas of our district, what with our under snow waters and the storms and the work in the fields, I don't see how it is possible to provide medical aid overall. And besides, I don't believe in medicine. Oh, well, that's unfair. I can quote to you thousands of instances. But the schools, at least? Why have schools? What do you mean? Can there be two opinions of the advantage of education? If it's a good thing for you, it's a good thing for everyone. Konstantin Levin felt himself morally pinned against a wall, and so he became heated and unconsciously blurted out the chief cause of his indifference to public business. Perhaps it may all be very good, but why should I worry myself about establishing dispensaries which I shall never make use of, and schools to which I shall never send my children, to which even the peasants don't want to send their children, and to which I've no very firm faith that they ought to send them, said he. Sergei Ivanovich was for a minute surprised at this unexpected view of the subject, but he promptly made a new plan of attack. He was silent for a little, drew out a hook, threw it in again, and turned to his brother, smiling. Come now. In the first place, the dispensary is needed. We ourselves sent for the district doctor, for Agatha Mikhailovna. Oh, well, but I fancy her wrist will never be straight again. That remains to be proved. Next, the peasant who can read and write is, as a workman, of more use and value to you. No, you can ask anyone you like, Konstantin Levin answered with decision. The man that can read and write is much inferior as a workman, and mending the high roads is an impossibility, and as soon as they put up bridges, they're stolen. Still, that's not the point, said Sergei Ivanovich, frowning. He disliked contradiction and still more arguments that were continually skipping from one thing to another, introducing new and disconnected points, so that there was no knowing to which to reply. Let me say, do you admit that education is a benefit for the people? Yes, I admit it, said Levin without thinking, and he was conscious immediately that he had said what he did not think. He felt that if he admitted it, it would be proved that he had been talking meaningless rubbish. How it would be proved he could not tell, but he knew that this would inevitably be logically proved to him, and he awaited the proof. The argument turned out to be far simpler than Konstantin Levin had expected. If you admit that it is a benefit, said Sergei Ivanovich, then as an honest man you cannot help caring about it and sympathizing with the movement, and so wishing to work for it. But I still do not admit this movement is good, said Konstantin Levin, reddening. What? But you just said now. That's to say, I don't admit its being either good or possible. That you can't tell without making the trial. Well, supposing that is so, said Levin, though he did not suppose so at all. Supposing that is so, still I don't see, all the same, why I should worry myself about it. How so? No, since we are talking, explain it to me from the philosophical point of view, said Levin. "I can't see where philosophy comes in," said Sergei Ivanovich in a tone Levin fancied, as though he did not admit his brother's right to talk about philosophy, and that irritated Levin. "I'll tell you then," he said with heat. "I imagine the mainspring of all our actions is, after all, self-interest. Now, in the Zemstvo institutions, I, as a nobleman, see nothing that could conduce to my prosperity. The roads are not better and could not be better. My horses carry me well enough over bad ones. Doctors and dispensaries are of no use to me. A justice of the peace is of no use to me. I never appeal to him and never shall appeal to him. The schools are of no good to me, but positively harmful, as I told you. For me, the Zemstvo institutions simply mean the liability of paying 18 kopecks for every dissiatina, of driving into the town, sleeping with bedbugs, and listening to all sorts of idiocy and blather and self-interest offers me no inducement." "Excuse me," Sergei Ivanovich interposed with a smile. "Self-interest did not induce us to work for the emancipation of the serfs, yet we did work for it." "No," Konstantin Levin broke in with still greater heat, "the emancipation of the serfs was a different matter. Their self-interest did come in. One longed to throw off that yoke that crushed us, all the decent people among us. But to be a member of the Zemstvo and discuss how many street cleaners are needed, and how sewers shall be constructed in the town in which I don't live, to serve on a jury and try a peasant who has stolen a flitch of bacon, and listen for 6 hours at a stretch to all sorts of jabber from the counsel for the defense and the prosecution, and the president cross-examining my old simpleton, Alyoshka, 'Do you admit, prisoner at the bar, the fact of the removal of the bacon?' Eh?" Konstantin Levin had warmed to his subject and began mimicking the president in the half-witted Alyoshka. It seemed to him that it was all to the point. But Sergei Ivanovich shrugged his shoulders. "Well, what do you mean to say then?" "I simply mean to say that those rights that touch me, my interests, I shall always defend to the best of my ability. That when raids are made on us students and the police read our letters, I was ready to defend those rights to the utmost, to defend my rights to education and freedom. I can understand compulsory military service, which affects my children, my brothers, and myself. I am ready to deliberate on what concerns me. But deliberating on how to spend 40,000 rubles of Zemstvo's money, or judging the half-witted Alyoshka, that I don't understand, and I can't do it." Konstantin Levin spoke as though the floodgates of his speech had burst open. Sergei Ivanovich smiled. "But tomorrow it will be your turn to be tried. Would it have suited your taste better to be tried in the old criminal court?" "I am not going to be tried. I shan't murder anybody, and I've no need of it. Well, I tell you what," he went on, flying off again to a subject quite beside the point. "Our district self-government and all the rest of it, it's just like the birch saplings we stick in the ground, as we would do it on Trinity Day, to look like a copse which has grown up of itself in Europe, and I can't gush over these birch saplings and believe in them." Sergei Ivanovich merely shrugged his shoulders as though to express his wonder how the birch saplings had come into their argument at that point, though he did really understand at once what his brother meant. "Excuse me, but you know one really can't argue in that way," he observed. But Konstantin Levin wanted to justify himself for the failing of which he was conscious, of a lack of zeal for the public welfare, and he went on. "I imagine," Konstantin said, "that no sort of activity is likely to be lasting if it is not founded on self-interest. That's a universal principle, a philosophical principle," he said, repeating the word philosophical with determination, as though wishing to show that he had as much right as anyone else to talk of philosophy. Sergei Ivanovich smiled. "He too has a philosophy of his own at the service of his natural tendencies," he thought. "Come, you'd better let philosophy alone," he said. "The chief problem of the philosophy of all ages consists precisely in finding that indispensable connection which exists between individual and social interests. But that's not to the point. What is to the point is a correction I must make in your comparison. The birches are not simply stuck in, but some are sown and some are planted, and one must deal carefully with them. It's only those people that have an intuitive sense of what's of importance and significance in their institutions and know how to value them, who have a future before them. It's only those peoples that one can truly call historical. And Sergei Ivanovich carried the subject into the regions of philosophical history, where Konstantin Levin could not follow him and showed him all the incorrectness of his outlook. As for your dislike of it, excuse my saying so, that's simply our Russian sloth and old serf owner's ways, and I'm convinced that in you it's a temporary error and will pass. Konstantin was silent. He felt himself vanquished on all sides, but he felt at the same time that what he wanted to say was unintelligible to his brother. Only he could not make up his mind whether it was unintelligible because he was not capable of expressing his meaning clearly, or because his brother would not or could not understand him. But he did not pursue the speculation, and without replying, he fell to musing on a quite different and personal matter. Sergei Ivanovich wound up the last line, unhitched the horse, and they drove off. Chapter 4. The personal matter that absorbed Levin during his conversation with his brother was this. Once, the year previous, he had gone to look at the mowing, and being made very angry by the bailiff, he had had recourse to his favorite means of regaining his temper. He had taken a scythe from a peasant and begun mowing. He liked the work so much that he had several times tried his hand at mowing since. He had cut the whole of the meadow in front of his house, and this year, ever since the early spring, he had cherished a plan for mowing for whole days together with the peasants. Ever since his brother's arrival, he had been in doubt as to whether to mow or not. He was loath to leave his brother alone all day long, and he was afraid his brother would laugh at him about it. But as he drove into the meadow and recalled the sensations of mowing, he came near deciding that he would go mowing. After the irritating discussion with his brother, he pondered over his intention again. I must have physical exercise or my temper will certainly be ruined, he thought, and he determined he would go mowing, however awkward he might feel about it with his brother or the peasants. Toward evening, Konstantin Levin went to his counting house, gave directions as to the work to be done, and sent about the village to summon the mowers for the morrow, to cut the hay in Kalinov Meadow, the largest and best of his grasslands. And send my scythe, please, to Tit, for him to set it, and bring it round tomorrow. I may do some mowing myself, too, he said, trying not to be embarrassed. The bailiff smiled and said, yes, sir. At tea the same evening, Levin said to his brother, too, I fancy the fine weather will last, said he. Tomorrow I shall start mowing. I'm so fond of that form of field labor, said Sergei Ivanovich. I'm awfully fond of it. I sometimes mow myself with the peasants, and tomorrow I want to try mowing the whole day. Sergei Ivanovich lifted his head and looked with curiosity at his brother. How do you mean? Just like one of the peasants. All day long? Yes, it's very pleasant, said Levin. It's splendid as exercise, only you'll hardly be able to stand it, said Sergei Ivanovich, without a shade of irony. I've tried it. It's hard work at first, but you get into it. I dare say I shall manage to keep it up. Oh, so that's it. But tell me, how do the peasants look at it? I suppose they laugh in their sleeves at their masters being such a queer fish. No, I don't think so, but it's so delightful, and at the same time such hard work that one has no time to think about it. But how will you do about dining with them? To send you a bottle of Lafitte and roast turkey out there would be a little awkward. No, I'll simply come home at the time of their noonday rest. Next morning, Konstantin Levin got up earlier than usual, but he was detained giving directions on the farm, and when he reached the mowing grass, the mowers were already at their second swath. From the uplands, he could get a view of the shaded cut part of the meadow below, with the grayish swaths and the black heaps of coats taken off by the mowers at the place from which they had started cutting. Gradually, as he rode toward the meadow, the peasants came into sight, some in coats, some in their shirts, mowing, one behind another in a long string, each slinging his scythe in his own way. He counted 42 of them. They were mowing slowly over the uneven, low-lying parts of the meadow where there had been an old dam. Levin recognized some of his own men. Here was old Ermil in a very long white smock, bending forward to swing a scythe. There was a young fellow, Vaska, who had been a coachman of Levin's, taking every swath with a wide sweep. Here, too, was Tit, Levin's preceptor in the art of mowing, a thin little peasant. He went on ahead and cut his wide swath without bending, as though playing with his scythe. Levin got off his mare and, fastening her up by the roadside, went to meet Tit, who took a second scythe out of a bush and gave it to him. "It's ready, sir. It's like a razor. It cuts of itself," said Tit, taking off his cap with a smile and giving him the scythe. Levin took the scythe and began trying it. As they finished their swaths, the mowers, hot and good-humored, came out into the road one after another and smirking greeted the master. They all stared at him, but no one made any remark, till a tall old man with a wrinkled, beardless face, wearing a short sheepskin jacket, came out into the road and accosted him. "Looky now, master, once take hold of the rope, there's no letting go," he said, and Levin heard smothered laughter among the mowers. "I'll try not to let it go," he said, taking his stand behind Tit and waiting for the time to begin. "Mindy," repeated the old man. Tit made room, and Levin started behind him. The grass was short, close to the road, and Levin, who had not done any mowing for a long while, and was disconcerted by the eyes fastened upon him, cut badly for the first moments, though he swung his scythe vigorously. Behind him he heard voices. "It's not set right. Handle's too high. See how he has to stoop to it," said one. "Press more on the heel of the scythe," said another. "Never mind, he'll get on all right," the old man resumed. "See, he's made a start. You swing it too wide, you'll tire yourself out. The master sure does his best for himself, but see the grass missed out? For such work, us fellows would catch it." The grass became lusher, and Levin, listening without answering, followed Tit, trying to do the best he could. They moved 100 paces. Tit kept moving on without stopping or showing the slightest weariness, but Levin was already beginning to fear he would not be able to keep up. So tired was he. He felt as he swung his scythe that he was at the very end of his strength and was making up his mind to ask Tit to stop. But at that very moment, Tit stopped of his own accord and, stooping down, picked up some grass, rubbed his scythe, and began wetting it. Levin straightened himself and, drawing a deep breath, looked round. Behind him came a peasant, and he too was evidently tired, for he stopped at once without waiting to mow up to Levin and began wetting his scythe. Tit sharpened his scythe and Levin's, and they went on. The next time it was just the same. Tit moved on with sweep after sweep of his scythe, without stopping or showing signs of weariness. Levin followed him, trying not to get left behind, and he found it harder and harder. The moment came when he felt he had no strength left, but at that very moment, Tit stopped and wetted the scythes. So they mowed the first row. And this long row seemed particularly hard work to Levin. But when the end was reached, and Tit, shouldering his scythe, began with deliberate stride returning on the track left by his heels in the cut grass, and Levin walked back in the same way over the space he had cut, in spite of the sweat that ran in streams over his face and fell in drops down his nose and drenched his back as though he had been soaked in water, he felt very happy. What delighted him particularly was that now he knew he would be able to hold out. His pleasure was only disturbed by his swath not being well cut. "I will swing less with my arm and more with my whole body," he thought, comparing Tit's swath, which looked as if it had been cut along a surveyor's cord, with his own scattered and irregularly lying grass. The first swath, as Levin noticed, Tit had mowed especially quickly, probably wishing to put his master to the test, and the swath happened to be a long one. The next swaths were easier, but still Levin had to strain every nerve not to drop behind the peasants. He thought of nothing, wished for nothing, save not to be left behind the peasants, and to do his work as well as possible. He heard nothing save the swish of scythes and saw before him Tit's upright figure mowing away, the crescent-shaped curve of the cut grass, the grass and flowers slowly and rhythmically falling before the blade of his scythe, and ahead of him the end of the swath, where would come the rest. Suddenly, in the midst of his toil, without understanding what it was or whence it came, he felt a pleasant sensation of chill on his hot, moist shoulders. He glanced at the sky in the interval for wetting the sighs. A heavy, lowering storm cloud had blown up, and big raindrops were falling. Some of the peasants went to their coats and put them on. Others, just like Levin himself, merely shrugged their shoulders, enjoying the pleasant coolness of it. Another swath and yet another swath followed, long swaths and short swaths, with good grass and with poor grass. Levin lost all sense of time and could not have told whether it were late or early now. A change began to come over his work, which gave him immense satisfaction. In the midst of his toil, there were moments during which he forgot what he was doing, and it all came easy to him. And at those same moments, his swath was almost as smooth and well-cut as tips. But as soon as he recollected what he was doing and began trying to do better, he was at once conscious of all the difficulty of his task, and the swath was badly mown. On finishing yet another swath, he would have gone back to the top of the meadow again to begin the next, but Tit stopped, and going up to the old man said something in a low voice to him. They both looked at the sun. What are they talking about, and why doesn't he go back, thought Levin, without guessing that the peasants had been mowing no less than 4 hours without stopping, and that it was time for their lunch. Lunch, sir, said the old man. Is it really time? Lunch it is, then. Levin gave his scythe to Tit, and together with the peasants who were crossing the long stretch of mown grass, slightly sprinkled with rain, to get their bread from the heap of coats, he went toward his horse. Only then did he suddenly awake to the fact that he had been wrong about the weather, and that the rain was drenching his hay. The hay will be spoiled, he said. Not a bit of it, sir. Mow in the rain, and you'll rake in fine weather, said the old man. Levin untied his horse and rode home to his coffee. Sergei Ivanovich was just getting up, but when he had drunk his coffee, Levin rode back again to the mowing before Sergei Ivanovich had had time to dress and come down to the dining room. Chapter 5. After lunch, Levin was not in the same place in the string of mowers as before, but stood between the old man who had accosted him jocosely and now invited him to be his neighbor, and a young peasant who had only been married in the autumn and who was mowing this summer for the first time. The old man, holding himself erect, moved in front, with his feet turned out, taking long, regular strides, and with a precise and regular action which seemed to cost him no more effort than swinging one's arms and walking, as though it were in play, he laid down the high, even swath of grass. It was as though it were not he, but the sharp scythe of itself, swishing through the juicy grass. Behind Levin came the lad Mishka. His comely, youthful face, with a twist of fresh grass bound round his hair, was all working with effort. But whenever anyone looked at him, he smiled. He would clearly have died sooner than own it was hard work for him. Levin kept between them. In the very heat of the day, the mowing did not seem such hard work to him. The perspiration with which he was drenched cooled him, while the sun that burned his back, his head, his arms, bare to the elbow, gave a vigor and dogged energy to his labor. And more often now came those moments of unconsciousness when it was possible not to think of what one was doing. The scythe cut of itself. These were happy moments. Still more delightful were the moments when they reached the stream where the swaths ended, and the old man rubbed his scythe with the wet, thick grass, rinsed its blade in the fresh water of the stream, ladled out a little in a whetstone case, and offered Levin a drink.
My class, hey. Good, eh? He would say, winking. And truly, Levin had never drunk any liquor as good as this warm water, with green bits floating in it, and a taste of rust from the tin whetstone case. And immediately after this came the delicious slow saunter, with his hand on the scythe, during which he could wipe away the steaming sweat, take deep breaths of air, and look about at the long string of mowers, and at what was happening around in the forest and the field. The longer Levin mowed, the oftener he felt the moments of unconsciousness, in which it seemed that it was not his hands which swung the scythe, but that the scythe was moving together with itself a body full of life and consciousness of its own. And as though by magic, without thinking of it, the work turned out regular and well finished of itself. There were the most blissful moments. It was only hard work when he had to break off the motion, which had become unconscious, and to think. when he had to mow around a hummock or an unweeded tuft of sorrel. The old man did this easily. When a hummock came, he changed his action, and at one time with the heel, and at another with the tip of his scythe, clipped the hummock round both sides with short strokes. And while he did this, he kept looking about and watching what came into his view. At one moment he picked a wild berry and ate it, or offered it to Levin. Then he flung away a twig with the blade of the scythe. Then he looked at a quail's nest, from which the bird flew just under the scythe, or caught a snake that crossed his path, and lifting it on the scythe as though on a fork, showed it to Levin and threw it away. For both Levin and the young peasant behind him, such changes of position were difficult. Both of them, repeating over and over again the same strange movement, were in a perfect frenzy of toil and were incapable of shifting their position and at the same time watching what was before them. Levin did not notice how time was passing. If he had been asked how long he had been working, he would have said half an hour. Yet it was getting on to dinner time. As they were walking back over the cut grass, the old man called Levin's attention to the little girls and boys, who were coming from different directions, hardly visible through the long grass, and along the road toward the mowers, carrying sacks of bread that stretched their little arms, and lugging small pitchers of kvass, stopped up with rags. "Looky at the little doodlebugs crawling," he said, pointing to them, and he shaded his eyes with his hand to look at the sun. They mowed two more swaths. The old man stopped. "Come, master, dinner time," he said decidedly. And on reaching the stream, the mowers moved off across the swaths toward their pile of coats, where the children who had brought their dinners were sitting waiting for them. The peasants gathered, those who came from afar under their telegas, those who lived near under a willow bush covered with grass. Levin sat down by them. He felt disinclined to go away. All constraint with the master had disappeared long ago. The peasants got ready for dinner. Some washed. The young lads bathed in the stream. Others made a place comfortable for a rest, untied their sacks of bread, and uncovered the pitchers of kvass. The old man crumpled up some bread in a cup, stirred it with the handle of a spoon, poured water on it from his whetstone case, broke up some more bread, and having seasoned it with salt, he turned to the east to say his prayer. "Come, master, taste my sop," said he, kneeling down before the cup. The sop was so good that Levin gave up the idea of going home for dinner. He ate with the old man and talked to him about his family affairs, taking the keenest interest in them, and told him about his own affairs and all the circumstances that could be of interest to the old man. He felt much nearer to him than to his brother, and could not help smiling at the affection he felt for this man. When the old man got up again, said his prayer, and lay down under a bush, putting some grass under his head for a pillow, Levin did the same, and in spite of the clinging flies that were so persistent in the sunshine, and the midges that tickled his hot face and body, he fell asleep at once and only waked when the sun had passed to the other side of the bush and reached him. The old man had been awake a long while, and was sitting up wetting the size of the younger lads. Levin looked about him and hardly recognized the place. Everything was so changed. The immense stretch of meadow had been mown and was sparkling with a peculiar fresh brilliance, with its lines of already sweet-smelling grass in the slanting rays of the evening sun. And the bushes about the river mowed around, and the river itself, not visible before, now gleaming like steel in its bends, and the moving, ascending peasants, and the sharp wall of grass of the unmown part of the meadow, and the hawks hovering over the striped meadow, all was perfectly new. Raising himself, Levin began considering how much had been cut, and how much more could still be done that day. The work done was exceptionally great for 42 men. They had cut the whole of the big meadow, which had, in the years of Corby, taken 30 scythes 2 days to mow. Only the corners remained to do where the swaths were short. But Levin felt a longing to get as much mowing done that day as possible, and was vexed with the sun sinking so quickly in the sky. He felt no weariness. All he wanted was to get his work done more and more quickly, and as much of it as possible. "Could we cut the Mashkin upland too? What do you think?" he said to the old man. "As God wills, the sun's not high. A little vodka for the lads?" At the afternoon rest, when they were sitting down again and those who smoked had lighted their pipes,
The old man told the men that the Mashkin Uplands is to be cut. There'll be vodka.
Why not cut it? Come on, Chit. We'll look sharp. We can eat at night. Come on.
Voices cried out, and eating up their bread, the mowers went back to work.
Come, lads, keep it up, said Chit, and ran on ahead, almost at a trot.
Get along, said the old man, hurrying after him and easily overtaking him. I'll mow thee down. Look out.
The young and old mowed away as though they were racing with one another, but however fast they worked, they did not spoil the grass, and the swaths were laid just as neatly and exactly. The little piece left uncut in the corner was mown in 5 minutes. The last of the mowers was just ending their swaths when the foremost snatched up their coats under their shoulders and crossed the road toward the Mashkin Upland. The sun was already sinking among the trees when they went with their jingling whetstone cases into the wooded ravine of the Mashkin Upland. The grass was up to their waists in the middle of the hollow, lush, tender, and feathery, spotted here and there among the trees with wild heartsease. After a brief consultation, whether to take the swaths lengthwise or diagonally, Prochor Ermilin, also a doughty mower, a huge black-haired peasant, went on ahead. He went up to the top, turned back again, and started mowing, and they all proceeded to form in line behind him, going downhill through the hollow and uphill right up to the edge of the forest. The sun sank behind the forest. The dew was falling by now. The mowers were in the sun only on the hillside, but below, where a mist was rising and on the opposite side, they mowed into the fresh, dewy shade. The work went rapidly. The spicily fragrant grass, cut with a succulent sound, was at once laid in high swaths. The mowers from all sides, brought closer together in the short swath, kept urging one another on to the sound of jingling whetstone cases and clanging scythes, and the hiss of the whetstone sharpening them, and good-humored shouts. Levin still kept between the young peasant and the old man. The old man, who had put on his short sheepskin jacket, was just as good-humored, jocose, and free in his movements. Among the trees they were continually cutting with their scythes the so-called birch mushrooms, swollen fat in the succulent grass. But the old man bent down every time he came across a mushroom, picked it up, and put it in his bosom. Another present for my old woman, he would say as he did so. Easy as it was to mow the wet, lush grass, it was hard work going up and down the steep sides of the ravine. But this did not trouble the old man. Swinging his scythe just as ever and moving his feet in their big, plated, bast sandals, with firm, short steps, he climbed slowly up the steep place. And though his breeches hanging out below his smock and his whole frame trembled with effort, he did not miss one blade of grass or one mushroom on his way, and kept making jokes with the peasants and Levin. Levin walked after him and often thought he must fall as he climbed with a scythe up a steep hillock, where it would have been hard work to clamber even without the scythe. But he climbed up and did what he had to do. He felt as though some external force were moving him. Chapter 6. The Mashkin Upland was mown, the last swaths finished, the peasants had put on their coats and were gaily trudging home. Levin got on his horse and, parting regretfully from the peasants, rode homeward. On the hillside he looked back. He could not see them in the mist that had risen from the valley. He could only hear their rough, good-humored voices, their laughter, and the sound of clanking scythes. Sergei Ivanovich had long ago finished dinner and was drinking iced lemonade in his own room, looking through the reviews and papers which he had just received by post, when Levin rushed into the room, talking merrily, with his wet and matted hair sticking to his forehead and his back and chest grimed and moist. "We mowed the whole meadow. Oh, it is fine, wonderful. And how have you been getting on?" said Levin, completely forgetting the disagreeable conversation of the previous day. "Dear me, what you look like," said Sergei Ivanovich, for the first moment looking around with some dissatisfaction. "And the door. Do shut the door," he cried. "You must have let in a dozen at least." Sergei Ivanovich could not endure flies, and in his own room he never opened the window except at night, and carefully kept the door shut. "Not one, on my honor. But if I have, I'll catch them. You wouldn't believe what a pleasure mowing is. How have you spent the day?" "Very well. But have you really been mowing the whole day? I expect you're as hungry as a wolf. Kuzma has got everything ready for you." "No, I don't feel hungry even. I had something to eat there, but I'll go and wash."
Yes, go along, and I'll come to you directly, said Sergei Ivanovich, shaking his head as he looked at his brother. Go along, make haste, he added, smiling, and gathering up his books, he prepared to go too. He, too, felt suddenly good-humored and disinclined to leave his brother's side. But what did you do while it was raining? Rain? Why, there was scarcely a drop. I'll come directly. So you had a good day, too. That's first rate. And Levin went off to change his clothes. 5 minutes later, their brothers met in the dining room. Although it seemed to Levin he was not hungry, and he sat down to dinner simply so as not to hurt Kuzma's feelings. Yet when he began to eat, the dinner struck him as extraordinarily good. Sergei Ivanovich watched him with a smile. Oh, by the way, there's a letter for you, said he. Kuzma, bring it from below, please, and mind you shut the doors. The letter was from Oblonsky. Levin read it aloud. Oblonsky wrote to him from Petersburg. I have had a letter from Dolly. She's at Ergushovo, and everything seems going wrong there. Do ride over and see her, please. Help her with advice. You know all about it. She will be so glad to see you. She's quite alone, poor thing. My mother-in-law and all of them are still abroad. That's capital. I will certainly ride over to her, said Levin. Or we'll go together. She's such a good woman, isn't she? They're not far from here, then? 30 verstas, or perhaps 40, but a capital road. It will be a capital drive. I shall be delighted, said Sergei Ivanovich, still smiling. The sight of his younger brother's appearance had immediately put him in a good humor. Well, you have an appetite, he said, looking at his dark, red, sunburned face and neck over the plate. Splendid. You can't imagine what an effective remedy it is for every sort of foolishness. I want to enrich medicine with a new word. Arbitskure. Well, but you don't need it, I should fancy. No, but for all sorts of nervous invalids. Yes, it ought to be tried. I had meant to come to the mowing to look at you, but it was so unbearably hot that I got no further than the forest. I sat there a little and went on by the forest to the village, met your old nurse and sounded her as to the peasant's view of you. As far as I can make out, they don't approve of this. She said, it's not a gentleman's work. Altogether, I fancy that in the people's idea they are very clear and definite notions of certain, as they call it, gentlemanly lines of action, and they don't sanction the gentlefolks moving outside bounds clearly laid down in their ideas. Maybe so, but anyway, it's a pleasure such as I have never known in my life, and there's no harm in it, you know, is there? Answered Levin. I can't help it if they don't like it, though I do believe it's all right, eh? Altogether, pursued Sergei Ivanovich, you're satisfied with your day? Quite satisfied. We cut the whole meadow, and I made friends with such a splendid old man there. You can't fancy how delightful he was. Well, so you're satisfied with your day, and so am I. First, I solved two chess problems, and one, a very pretty one, a pawn opening. I'll show it to you. And then I thought over our conversation of yesterday. Oh, yes, our conversation of yesterday, said Levin, blissfully dropping his eyelids and drawing deep breaths after finishing his dinner, and absolutely incapable of recalling what their conversation of yesterday had been about. I think you are partly right. Our difference of opinion amounts to this, that you make the mainspring self-interest, while I contend that interest in the common weal is bound to exist in every man of a certain degree of advancement. Possibly you are right, too. That action founded on material interest would be more desirable. You are altogether, as the French say, too prime sortir a nature. You must have intense, energetic action or nothing. Levin listened to his brother and did not understand a single word and did not want to understand. He was only afraid his brother might ask him some question which would make it evident he had not heard. So that's what I think it is, my dear boy, said Sergei Ivanovich, touching him on the shoulder. Yes, of course, but do you know... I won't stand up for my view, answered Levin with a guilty childlike smile. Whatever was it I was disputing about, he wondered. Of course I'm right, and he's right, and it's all first rate. Only I must go round to the counting house and see to things. He got up, stretching and smiling. Sergei Ivanovich smiled too. If you want to go out, let's go together, he said, disinclined to be parted from his brother, who seemed positively breathing out freshness and energy. Come, we'll go to the counting house if you have to go there. Oh, heavens, shouted Levin so loudly that Sergei Ivanovich was quite frightened.
What? What is the matter? How's Agatha Mikhailovna's hand? Said Levin, slapping himself on the head. I'd positively forgotten her. It's much better. Well, anyway, I'll run down to her. Before you've time to get your hat on, I'll be back. And he ran downstairs, clattering with his heels like a spring rattle. Chapter 7 Stepan Arkadyevich had gone to Petersburg to perform the most natural and essential official duty, so familiar to everyone in the government service, though incomprehensible to outsiders. That duty, but for which one could hardly be in government service, of reminding the ministry of his existence and having, for the due performance of this right, taken all the available cash from home, was gaily and agreeably spending his days at the races and in the summer villas. Meanwhile, Dolly and the children had moved into the country to cut down expenses as much as possible. She had gone to Ergushova, the estate that had been her dowry, and the one where in spring the forest had been sold. It was nearly 50 verstas from Levin's Pokrovsko. The big old house at Ergushova had been pulled down long ago, and the old prince had had the wing done up and added to. 20 years before, when Dolly was a child, the wing had been roomy and comfortable, though, like all wings, it stood sideways to the entrance avenue and to the south. But by now this wing was old and dilapidated. When Stepan Arkadyevich had gone down in the spring to sell the forest, Dolly had begged him to look over the house and order what repairs might be needed. Stepan Arkadyevich, like an unfaithful husband indeed, was very solicitous for his wife's comfort, and he had himself looked over the house and given instructions about everything that he considered necessary. What he considered necessary was to cover all the furniture with new cretonne, to put up curtains, to weed the garden, to make a little bridge on the pond, and to plant flowers. But he forgot many other essential matters, the want of which greatly distressed Darya Alexandrovna later on. In spite of Stepan Arkadyevich's efforts to be an attentive father and husband, he never could keep in his mind that he had a wife and children. He had bachelor tastes, and it was in accordance with them that he shaped his life. On his return to Moscow, he informed his wife with pride that everything was ready, that the house would be a pretty toy, and that he most certainly advised her to go. His wife staying away in the country was very agreeable to Stepan Arkadyevich from every point of view. It did the children good, it decreased expenses, and it left him more at liberty. Darya Alexandrovna regarded staying in the country for the summer as essential for the children, especially for the little girl, who had not succeeded in regaining her strength after the scarlatina, and also as a means of escaping the petty humiliations, the little bills owing to the wood merchant, the fishmonger, the shoemaker, which made her miserable. Besides this, she was pleased to go away to the country because she was dreaming of getting her sister Kitty to stay with her there. Kitty was to be back from abroad in the middle of the summer, and bathing had been prescribed for her. Kitty wrote that no prospect was so alluring as to spend the summer with Dolly at Ergushovna, full of childhood associations for both of them. The first days of her existence in the country were very hard for Dolly. She used to stay in the country as a child, and the impression she had retained of it was that the country was a refuge from all the unpleasantness of the town, that life there, though not luxurious, Dolly could easily make up her mind to that, was cheap and comfortable, that there was plenty of everything, everything was cheap, everything could be got, and children were happy. But now, coming to the country as the head of a family, she perceived that it was all utterly unlike what she had fancied. The day after their arrival there was a heavy fall of rain, and in the night the water came through in the corridor and in the nursery, so that the beds had to be carried into the drawing room. There was no kitchen maid to be found. Of the 9 cows, it appeared from the words of the cowherd woman that some were about to calve. Others had just calved, others were old, and others again hard-uddered. There was neither butter nor milk enough even for the children. There were no eggs. They could get no fowls. Old, purplish, stringy roosters were all they had for roasting and boiling. Impossible to get women to scrub the floors. All were potato hoeing. Driving was out of the question because one of the horses was rested and bolted in the shafts. There was no place where they could bathe. The whole of the river bank was trampled by the cattle and open to the road. Even walks were impossible, for the cattle strayed into the garden through a gap in the hedge,
and there was one terrible bull who bellowed and therefore might be expected to gore somebody. There were no proper covers for their clothes. What covers there were either would not close at all or flew open whenever anyone passed by them. There were no pots and kettles. There was no boiler in the washhouse, nor even an ironing board in the maid's room. Finding instead of peace and rest all these, from her point of view, fearful calamities, Darya Alexandrovna was at first in despair. She exerted herself to the utmost, felt the hopelessness of the position, and was every instant suppressing the tears that started into her eyes. The bailiff, a retired quartermaster, whom Stepan Arkadyevitch had taken a fancy to, and had appointed bailiff on account of his handsome and respectful appearance as a hall porter, showed no sympathy for Darya Alexandrovna's woes. He would say respectfully, "Nothing can be done. The peasants are such a wretched lot," and did nothing to help her. The position seemed hopeless, but in the Oblonsky's household, as in all families indeed, there was one inconspicuous but most valuable and useful person, Matryona Filimonovna. She soothed her mistress, assured her that everything would come round. It was her expression, and Matvey had borrowed it from her, and without fuss or hurry proceeded to set to work herself. She had immediately made friends with the bailiff's wife, and on the very first day she drank tea with her and the bailiff under the acacias and reviewed all the circumstances of the position. Very soon, Matryona Filimonovna had established her club, so to say, under the acacias, and there it was, in this club, consisting of the bailiff's wife, the village elder, and the counting house clerk, that the difficulties of existence were gradually smoothed away, and in a week's time everything actually had come round. The roof was mended, a kitchen maid was found, a crony of the village elders. Hens were bought, the cows began giving milk, the garden hedge was stocked up with stakes, the carpenter made a mangle, hooks were put in the cupboards, and they ceased to fly open spontaneously, and an ironing board covered with army cloth was placed across from the arm of a chair to the chest of drawers, and there was a smell of flat irons in the maid's room. "Just see now, and you are quite in despair," said Matryona Filimonovna, pointing to the ironing board. They even rigged up a bathing shed of straw hurdles. Lily began to bathe, and Darya Alexandrovna began to realize, if only in part, her expectations, if not of a peaceful, at least of a comfortable life in the country. Peaceful with six children, Darya Alexandrovna could not be. One would fall ill, another might easily become so, a third would be without something necessary, a fourth would show symptoms of a bad disposition, and so on. Rare indeed were the brief periods of peace. But these cares and anxieties were for Darya Alexandrovna the sole happiness possible. Had it not been for them, she would have been left alone to brood over her husband who did not love her. And besides, hard though it was for the mother to bear the dread of illness, the illnesses themselves and the grief of seeing signs of evil propensities in her children, the children themselves were even now repaying her in small joys for her pains. Those joys were so small that they passed unnoticed, like gold and sand, and at bad moments she could see nothing but the pain, nothing but sand. But there were good moments, too, when she saw nothing but the joy, nothing but gold. Now, in the solitude of the country, she began to be more and more frequently aware of those joys. Often looking at them, she would make every possible effort to persuade herself that she was mistaken, that she, as a mother, was partial to her children. All the same, she could not help saying to herself that she had charming children, all six of them in different ways, but a set of children such as is not often to be met with, and she was happy in them and proud of them. Chapter 8. Toward the end of May, when everything had been more or less satisfactorily arranged, she received her husband's answer to her complaints of the disorganized state of things in the country. He wrote begging her forgiveness for not having thought of everything before, and promised to come down at the first chance. This chance did not present itself. Until the beginning of June, Darya Alexandrovna stayed alone in the country. On the Sunday in St. Peter's week, Darya Alexandrovna drove to Mass to have all her children take the sacrament.
Darya Alexandrovna in her intimate philosophical talks with her sister, her mother, and her friends, very often astonished them by the freedom of her views in regard to religion. She had a strange religion, all her own, of the transmigration of souls in which she had firm faith, troubling herself little about the dogmas of the church. But in her family she was strict in carrying out all that was required by the church, and not merely in order to set an example, but with all her heart. The fact that the children had not been at the sacrament for nearly a year worried her extremely, and with the full approval and sympathy of Matryona Filimonovna, she decided that this should take place now in the summer. For several days before, Darya Alexandrovna was busily deliberating on how to dress all the children. Frocks were made or altered, washed, seams and flounces were let out, buttons were sewn on, and ribbons got ready. One dress, Tanya's, which the English governess had undertaken, cost Darya Alexandrovna much loss of temper. The English governess, in altering it, had made the seams in the wrong place, had taken up the sleeves too much, and altogether spoiled the dress. It was so narrow on Tanya's shoulders that it was quite painful to look at her. But Matryona Filimonovna had the happy thought of putting in gussets and adding a little shoulder cape. The dress was set right, but there was nearly a quarrel with the English governess. In the morning, however, all was happily arranged, and about 9 o'clock, the time at which they had asked the priest to wait for them for the Mass, the children in their new dresses stood with beaming faces on the step before the carriage, waiting for their mother. In the carriage, instead of the rest of Raven, they had harnessed, thanks to the representations of Matryona Filimonovna, the bailiff's horse, Brownie, and Darya Alexandrovna, delayed by anxiety over her own attire, came out and got in, dressed in a white muslin gown. Darya Alexandrovna had done her hair and dressed with care and excitement. In the old days, she had dressed for her own sake, to look pretty and be admired. Later on, as she got older, dress became more and more distasteful to her. She saw that she was losing her good looks, but now she began to feel pleasure and interest in dress again. Now she did not dress for her own sake, not for the sake of her own beauty, but simply that, as the mother of those exquisite creatures, she might not spoil the general effect. And looking at herself for the last time in the looking-glass, she was satisfied with herself. She looked well, not as well as she wished to look in the old days at a ball, but well for the object she now had in view. In the church there was no one but the peasants, the servants, and their womenfolk. But Darya Alexandrovna saw, or fancied she saw, the sensation produced by her children and herself. The children were not only beautiful to look at in their smart little dresses, but they were charming in the way they behaved. Alyosha, it is true, did not stand quite correctly. He kept turning round, trying to look at his little jacket from behind. But all the same, he was wonderfully sweet. Tanya behaved like a grown-up person and looked after the little ones. And the smallest Lily was bewitching in her naive astonishment at everything. And it was difficult not to smile when, after taking the sacrament, she said in English, "Please, some more." On the way home, the children felt that something solemn had happened and were very sedate. Everything went happily at home, too, but at lunch, Grisha began whistling, and what was worse, was disobedient to the English governess, and was forbidden to have any tart. Darya Alexandrovna would not have let things go as far as the punishment on such a day had she been present, but she had to support the English governess's authority, and she upheld her decision that Grisha should have no tart. This rather spoiled the general good humor. Grisha cried, declaring that Nikolinka had whistled too, yet was not punished, and that he wasn't crying for the tart, he didn't care, but at being unjustly treated. This was really too tragic, and Darya Alexandrovna made up her mind to persuade the English governess to forgive Grisha, and she went to speak to her. But on her way, as she passed the drawing room, she beheld a scene, filling her heart with such pleasure that the tears came into her eyes, and she forgave the delinquent herself. The culprit was sitting at the window in the corner of the drawing room. Beside him was standing Tanya with a plate. On the pretext of wanting to give some dinner to her dolls, she had asked the governess permission to take her share of tart to the nursery, and had taken it instead to her brother. While still weeping over the injustice of his punishment, he was eating the tart, and kept saying through his sobs, "Eat yourself, let's eat it together, together." Tanya had at first been under the influence of her pity for Grisha, then of a sense of her noble action, and tears were standing in her eyes, too, but she did not refuse and ate her share. On catching sight of her mother, they were dismayed, but looking into her face, they saw they were not doing wrong. They burst out laughing, and with their mouths full of tart, they began wiping their smiling lips with their hands and smearing their radiant faces all over with tears and jam. "Mercy, your new white frock, Tanya, Grisha," said their mother, trying to save the frock, but with tears in her eyes, smiling a blissful, rapturous smile. The new frocks were taken off, and orders were given for the little girls to have their blouses put on, and the boys their old jackets, and the wide droshky to be harnessed, with Brownie, to the bailiff's annoyance, again in the shafts, to drive out for mushroom picking and bathing. A roar of delighted shrieks arose in the nursery, and never ceased till they had set off for the bathing place. They gathered a whole basket full of mushrooms. Even Lily found a birch mushroom. It had always happened before that Miss Hooley found them and pointed them out to her, but this time she found a big one quite by herself, and there was a general scream of delight. "Lily has found a mushroom!" Then they reached the river, put the horses under the birch tree, and went to the bathing place. The coachman, Terenty, hitched the horses, who kept whisking away the horseflies, to a tree, and treading down the grass, lay down in the shade of a birch and smoked his shag, while the never-ceasing shrieks of delight of the children floated across to him from the bathing place. Though it was hard work to look after all the children and restrain their pranks, though it was difficult, too, to keep one's head and not mix up all the stockings, little breeches, and shoes for the different legs, and to undo and do up again all the tapes and buttons, Darya Alexandrovna, who had always liked bathing herself and believed it to be very good for the children, enjoyed nothing so much as bathing with all the children. To go over all those fat little legs pulling on their stockings, to take in their arms and dip those little naked bodies, and to hear their screams of delight and alarm, to see the breathless faces with wide-open, scared, and happy eyes of all her splashing cherubs was a great pleasure to her. When half the children had been dressed, some peasant woman in holiday dress, out picking herbs, came up to the bathing shed and stopped shyly. Matryona Filimonovna called one of them and handed her a sheet and a shirt that had dropped into the water for her to dry them, and Darya Alexandrovna began to talk to the women. At first they laughed behind their hands and did not understand her questions, but soon they grew bolder and began to talk, winning Darya Alexandrovna's heart at once by the genuine admiration of the children that they showed. "My, what a beauty! As white as sugar," said one, admiring Tanechka and shaking her head. "But thin." "Yes, she has been ill." "Looky, they've been bathing him too," said another, pointing to the breast baby. "No, he's only 3 months old," answered Darya Alexandrovna with pride. "You see? And have you any children?" "I've had 4. I've 2 living, a boy and a girl. I weaned her last carnival." "How old is she?" "Why, more than 1 year old." "Why did you nurse her so long?" "It's our custom, for 3 fasts." And the conversation became most interesting to Darya Alexandrovna. What sort of time did she have? What was the matter with the boy? Where was her husband? Did it often happen? Darya Alexandrovna felt disinclined to leave the peasant woman. So interesting to her was their conversation. So completely identical were all their interests. What pleased her most of all was that she saw clearly what all the women admired more than anything was her having so many children and such fine ones. The peasant women even made Darya Alexandrovna laugh and offended the English governess because she was the cause of the laughter she did not understand. One of the younger women kept staring at the Englishwoman who was dressing after all the rest, and when she put on her 3rd petticoat, she could not refrain from the remark, "My, she keeps putting on and putting on, and she'll never have done," she said, and they all went off into peals of laughter. Chapter 9. On the drive home, as Darya Alexandrovna, with all her children round her, their heads still wet from their baths and a kerchief tied over her own head, was getting near the house, the coachman said, "There's some gentleman coming, the master of Pogrovsko, I do believe." Darya Alexandrovna peeped out in front and was delighted when she recognized, in the gray hat and gray coat, the familiar figure of Levin walking to meet them. She was glad to see him at any time, but at this moment she was especially glad he should see her in all her glory. No one was better able to appreciate her grandeur than Levin. Seeing her, he found himself face to face with one of the pictures of his daydream of family life. "You're like a hen with your brood, Darya Alexandrovna." "Ah, how glad I am to see you," she said, holding out her hand to him. "Glad to see me. But you didn't let me know. My brother's staying with me. I got a note from Stiva that you were here." "From Stiva?" Darya Alexandrovna asked with surprise. "Yes, he writes that you are here and that he thinks you might allow me to be of use to you," said Levin. And as he said it, he became suddenly embarrassed, and stopping abruptly, he walked on in silence by the droshky, snapping off the buds of the lime trees and nibbling them. He was embarrassed through a sense that Darya Alexandrovna would be annoyed by receiving from an outsider help that should by rights have come from her own husband. Darya Alexandrovna certainly did not like this little way of Stepan Arkadyevich's of fostering his domestic duties on others, and she was at once aware that Levin was aware of this. It was just for this fineness of perception, for this delicacy, that Darya Alexandrovna liked Levin. "I know, of course," said Levin, "that this simply means that you would like to see me, and I am exceedingly glad. Though I can fancy that, used to town housekeeping as you are, you must feel you are in the wilds here, and if there's anything wanted, I'm altogether at your disposal." "Oh, no," said Dolly. "At first things were rather uncomfortable, but now we've settled everything capitally, thanks to my old nurse," she said, indicating Matryona Filimonovna, who, seeing that they were speaking of her, smiled brightly and cordially to Levin. She knew him, and knew that he would be a good match for her young lady, and was very keen to see the matter settled. "Won't you get in, sir? We'll make room on this side," she said to him. "No, I'll walk. Children, who'd like to race the horses with me?"